I'm John Aran, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity. I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media. Available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Grant and Danny on The Fan, all over the DMV on our flagship 106.7. We're also in Richmond on AM 910 and FM 105.1. You can listen to us coast to coast on the Odyssey app, and you can watch us streamed on YouTube on the 106.7 The Fan YouTube page each and every day. You can't tell us you're not listening for lack of options.
We give you options.
We're giving you a bunch of them. The exclusive sponsor of our show is the law firm Connery & Murad. They'll guide you and your family in the right direction and helping you to draft a will, set up a trust, create a healthcare power of attorney. Schedule a free consultation with their estate planning attorneys at kmlawyers.com. Be sure to tell them G&D sent you to get a discount. That's kmlawyers.com. Our guy Warren Sharp, Sharp Analytics, is on the BetQL guest hotline right now. Bet smarter to beat the books. Download the BetQL app. Visit BetQL.com. Warren, good to talk to you again. It's been a while. How are you, man?
I'm doing great. Week one in the books. Obviously, I know you guys want to talk a little bit about Jaden Daniels, but it was fun to see him out there under live fire, getting some real game reps finally. So looking forward to what happens in week two.
Yeah, I think we are too in town because, like everybody else, we're trying to figure out how much of this was a game in a week-to-week league that we're overreacting to and how much is kind of gospel moving forward and how this season's going to look. But let's dive into Daniels first and foremost. You did a nice video breakdown today. People can go check out on your Twitter account where you looked at what he did well, what didn't work. Give us kind of your thoughts on his first game.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is the difficult part. When we're talking about, you know, some of the coach speak afterwards, and we're talking about what Jaden Daniels should look like moving forward and what the coaches want him to do, the tricky part is this. Obviously, he's making his first career start. It's on the road, and it's against Todd Bowles' defense. Those are all very difficult things for any quarterback to do. But I always look at it like, what was he being coached to do in the preseason? So keep this in your frame of reference as you're trying to think about him and what you might expect from him during the season, and particularly week one, as you use a barometer here. In the preseason, Jaden Daniels' time to throw was 1.91 seconds. There were 106 quarterbacks in the NFL preseason with over five dropbacks. That was the lowest. That was 106 out of 106. He had the fastest time to throw. He was being coached to get rid of the ball quickly. Make a decision, first check, go. Get rid of the ball. His air yards per attempt was 5.9 yards. That is very low. That was number 88 out of 106 quarterbacks. He was being asked to throw underneath on almost all of his passes. So when you look at Jaden Daniels and you say, like, oh, well, at LSU, he was able to do this, and then here I'm seeing him in Tampa, and he's doing this. The fact of the matter is, when you put a quarterback under live fire, he's probably going to fall back on what he was being told to do in the preseason and actually executed in the preseason. It's much more difficult to say, okay, you should come in and hang in the pocket and go through your progressions and not run the football and just sit back there for 2, 3, 4 seconds and try to go through your progression. I'm not going to knock him for not doing any of that yet because he wasn't being coached to do that in the preseason. So obviously there are things that Jaden Daniels needs to work on. Some of it relates to passing the ball down the field. Some of it relates to being able to slide better when he does take off to run the football. But what I would like to share, and I do have feelings on, is, you know, if we're going to talk about Jaden Daniels running and it being too much, like Dan Quinn was saying, the place to start is cutting down on the designed runs that are not near the end zone. That is the place to start if we're talking about helping Jaden Daniels, not the scrambles when he is under pressure and he has no frame of reference in any of the preseason games that the coaching staff is going to work with him on standing in the pocket and resetting and setting up different pockets. I was reading the Thomas Boswell article about, you know, reestablishing, and, you know, I agree with Thomas. That's probably on the coaching staff because he wasn't being asked to do that in the preseason, but we can't knock Jaden Daniels for not doing that here in week one on the road against Todd Bowles' defense.
So Warren, it's such a tough balance. I think you did a great job of talking about this in that video, in that breakdown, where the skill set's incredible, like the ability to take a pressure and turn it into a positive gain for your team in terms of running. And there were moments maybe, hey, you could have thrown this ball or otherwise, but you're still ending up with these a 17-yard gain down the left sideline for a first down, one of their largest plays of the day for a pretty anemic offense. But you know, the big picture is at some point, some of those could be throws to hit touchdowns if you're buying more time and or big plays. And other times, you know, maybe you're running the risk of getting hit. Like, it's just such a hard balance. And it's always like whatever happens after the fact, we want to go back and correct it with hindsight. What's the lesson? What's the balance there that the coaches in here are going to try to walk?
Yeah, that's a great point. And it is difficult. I'm sure most people who are listening did not see the article or hear my take on it. So the bottom line is Jaden Daniels had 16 runs. Seven of those runs were scrambles when it was a design pass play and he took off and ran with the football. Those plays averaged gains of 11 yards. Obviously, you and I both know this. That's way better than the average pass play. An 11-yard gain is way better than an average pass play. Those plays averaged 86% success and 1.15 EPA per attempt. If you look at what he did when he actually dropped back and tried to pass the football, he averaged 7.7 yards per attempt, 46% success, and negative 0.13 EPA per attempt. So much, much worse when he was actually sitting in the pocket trying to throw the ball down the field. Yes, looking back at some of those scrambles, there was one play in particular with Terry McLaurin where Daniels did have a pocket, should have stayed in the pocket, should not have run for the first down. Keep in mind, he did get a first down on that run, but that was seven waiting to happen if he hit that down the field. But most of these other scrambles where he's scrambling, I thought were the right decision for a young quarterback who was not asked to buy time in the pocket during the preseason and has no frame of reference for that. In addition, we're talking about when a quarterback is most likely to get injured, and studies have shown, although it's such a one-off scenario, and obviously we know what's happened to some quarterbacks around the league, like RG3, that you guys have perfect experience with that, you are actually are more likely to be injured if you're sitting in the pocket trying to read out a pass, read out the routes and staying in the pocket, then you are scrambling down the field. And the reason is simple. When you're scrambling down the field, you have, generally speaking, a better frame of reference to see who's coming at you and to adjust your body before them. Whereas if you're in the pocket looking down the field, you got guys falling at your legs and you're really focused down the field. You're not focused on protecting yourself. Whereas if you're running, that could be your number one focus. But as it relates to should you scramble, should you hang in the pocket? I mean, obviously, like you said, hindsight's 20/20, but I want to share these stats, which I didn't talk about in the video or the article. Since 2021, on drives that start out or inside a team's 30-yard line, so we're not talking about drives that start near the end zone in scoring territory already, drives where you're going to have to go to the length of the field like an average drive. If you do not take a sack, 35% of the time you're going to score points. If you take one sack, just one sack on that drive, only 19% of the time will you score points. If you don't take a sack, 22% of the time, you're going to score a touchdown. If you take just one sack, that is cut in third to 8% of the time, you will score a touchdown. So you wanted to hang in the pocket, yes, but if you're taking a sack a la a Daniel Jones, who has no concept of pressure at all, like think about this. You guys are going to go up against this guy this weekend. Daniel Jones is the blueprint for what I think some Commanders fans might be arguing that you want a little bit more out of Jaden Daniels, which is absurd to me. You're going to see on Sunday when you watch Daniel Jones, if he's anything like he's been in his career or in week one, a quarterback who has no feel for pressure, who is hanging in the pocket far too long and takes unnecessary and unneeded sacks and hits and potentially fumbles the football as a result. But more than importantly, he takes those sacks, which are drive killers, which forces the team to punt the football. You do not want that from your quarterback. And I also don't think that you want a guy who's just going to chuck the ball out of bounds at the sign of first pressure. I know he's had a great career, but that's like what Derek Carr does. If you're looking for a true game-changing, difference-making quarterback, you need him to be healthy out on the field. I 100% agree. But you need a guy who is going to be able to take the yards that are there on a particular given play. And hopefully it's through the air, but when it's not, and when there's a question, his skill set allows him to run the football. Just get down. Take. It's okay if you're not getting that 11th and 12th yard. Take the 10 if it means that you're not putting your body in harm's way. I 100% agree with that. That's what they need to be working on first and foremost with him when he does run the football.
Great info from Warren Sharp here on Grant and Danny. I think there's probably a happy medium, though, between like Daniel Jones and wide receivers having 19 yards in the game before the final drive in garbage time, right? Or a 12 completion performance where he's literally run more than he's completed passes in the middle of the fourth quarter. So I don't know. I don't need him to be Daniel Jones and have no feel.
We don't want that.
But I'd like to major in him looking to make plays through the air and minor in the runs, or at least get to a point where we're trending in that direction and coaching him up. And that's the part I don't know, Warren. Are they coaching him up in that way or not?
Yeah, well, that's exactly the question, you know, with Cliff Kingsbury. And that's why I think it's so important to take the context of what was he doing in the preseason. You know, what was he being asked to do? Because you're not just going to be able to flip a switch. This is what I want my quarterbacks to get a little bit of reps in the preseason. I think this is why we saw passing touchdowns at like a historic low since like 2006 in week one, because none of these quarterbacks are getting any reps in the preseason. But you're going to, especially if you're a rookie, you're going to trend a little bit more to what you were doing in the preseason. I think if you look at what Jaden Daniels was doing in the preseason, then you push that forward to week one. Like you said, you've got your two top leading receivers are both running backs, and your number three is a tight end in Zach Ertz, which you and I both know from watching him in Philadelphia. Like, his glory years are far behind him. He should not be he maybe should be your third best highest targeted receiver, but not behind two running backs and no wide receivers. So it's dialing up. What they were doing is they were manufacturing a lot of easy passes for Jaden Daniels underneath to the guys that are closest to him at the line of scrimmage. The guys that are closest to him are running backs and tight ends. So it's a lot of underneath stuff that's being manufactured as your first read, get the ball out quickly. But the stuff to the wide receivers that needs to be there, they need to build that up a little bit more. So it's on everybody. But more so for a rookie quarterback, it's on the coaching staff. There's no doubt about it. Like, they need to work with him a little bit more on that. But you can't be fearful about the scrambling. You fear for the safety. But in my opinion, if you want less than 16 runs, knock off all the design stuff, which most of it came in the second half when you're down somewhat bit large. And focus a little bit more. If you want to run the ball with your backs, focus on it then. Focus on some of those early downs, getting the ball to the wide receivers. Don't wait to try to get to the wide receivers until third down, because on third down, that's the most likely time that you're going to be blitzed, most obvious passing situation. Throw some of these passes where the first read is Terry McLaurin on a first down. Make life easy for McLaurin and, most importantly, for Jaden Daniels. And I do agree with you. That is a happy medium is absolutely necessary here. It's going to take time. It's going to take time. I just wish, you know, right out the gate after his first game, that Dan Quinn doesn't come out and, you know, put him on blast for running with the ball like this. Like, knock off the designed runs then if you don't want him. But scrambling is such a valuable tool. Just do it a little bit more intelligently.
Follow our guest, Warren Sharp, at Sharp Football on Elon's app. So I want to deep dive real quick, Warren, into Kingsbury's offense. I mean, it looked, and listen, I haven't studied the All-22 in depth and charted everything that he was doing in Arizona, but it felt very Arizona-y to me, right? Where, you know, his number one wide receiver is lining up on the left side, very little motion, very little dynamic, and it's a lot of horizontal, quick stuff, kind of the things that you alluded to. Is there an evolution coming, or is we're sort of just, this is it?
I mean, there will be once he gets more familiar with the various personnel, and there's going to be a learning curve. I mean, there's going to be things that Jaden Daniels is going to be able to get to later on the season in terms of progressions and routes and that he's not able to at this very moment. And that's okay to me. It's a learning curve. But the one thing I will say about Cliff Kingsbury, you know, he worked with a rookie quarterback in Arizona. Kyler Murray was a rookie when Cliff Kingsbury was there. And Kyler Murray had a lot of success with this offense when he was there. Kyler Murray that season had 93 rushing attempts, though. That was the third most for any quarterback. He had 544 yards rushing. That was the number two most for any quarterback, and four rushing touchdowns, which was the number four most. He also took the number three most sacks at 48. But this team had a lot of success of getting to the red zone. They just weren't converting when they were down inside of the red zone. I think that you're going to see Cliff Kingsbury use Jaden Daniels' mobility, just again, reduce these obvious run plays on these designed quarterback runs, unless you're near the end zone. I don't want to say I'm excited, because I do think you're lacking at the receiver position from a talent perspective. You don't have like three stud receivers just be out there in 11 like the Seattle Seahawks might, and just be able to attack all levels of the field and have the secondary just pulling their hair out because they've got so many great wide receivers to cover. You don't have that going on in D.C., but there's a lot of balance that I think you need to find, and I think Kingsbury will get there. I do not think that he is one of the best offensive coordinators in the NFL, however, so I mean, there is a ceiling here, but I think it's going to get a lot better. Your schedule is going to be full of a lot of challenging defenses as it relates to the NFC East in particular, and in addition, you're playing the AFC North, so you're going up against all those ridiculous defenses. So there's going to be games when it actually looks a lot worse sometimes than what it did this past week, and just be ready for those bumps and bruises along the way. That's going to be what happens when you've got a young quarterback who, just look at what he did in college. His scramble rate on pressures is one of the highest that we've seen. Like, he tends to scramble when he's pressured. So I just think it's a mistake if you're expecting him to suddenly, with the flip of the switch, be under pressure, stay in the pocket, read out the defenses. I think he might actually get injured in the pocket if he's trying to do that, because this is something that's going to take time. It's not going to come overnight. You can't just expect him to do that in week two against the Giants or in week three against the Cincinnati Bengals on Monday Night Football.
Warren Sharp on G&D, always love chatting ball with him. All right, let me ask you one more on Kingsbury. I'm going to dive into some specific numbers here. The fastest pace of play in week one, Washington snapped the ball with the most time left on the play clock. So they were the fastest moving team, which I'm in on. I'm all for that. But they were sixth worst, 27th of 32 in snap motion percentage, like basically motion at the snap. Listen to these other teams that were worse than them, and you find me a team that is good on offense. The Browns, the Patriots, the Panthers, the Jaguars, the Bengals. Now, maybe those teams will get better, but they were dreadful in week one. I guess I bring this up to say, this was one of the things that bothered me about Kingsbury's offense previously, to double down on what Danny said, and it seems like this is his plan. Like, I can count one time I saw when I watched back, McLaurin was in motion before the snap. He lined up on the same side of the formation like 43 of 49 times. Weird that you could take him out of the game when you know exactly where he's going to be. How much of a Kingsbury fan are you, I guess, would be my long-winded question.
No, it's a good question. You raised some valid points. As you were speaking, I just dove into the statistics, not to scare you guys, but I'm going to go ahead and scare you and all the listeners.
Great.
That in 2020, which was, I believe that was Kyler Murray's rookie season in Arizona. If it's not, tell me and I'll change the year. But Cliff Kingsbury's motion rate for the Arizona Cardinals, pre-snap motion, 27%, dead last in the NFL. So Cliff Kingsbury, this is Cliff Kingsbury, and it's not changing. I was not necessarily a fan of him coming to D.C. That's why I was saying I think that there is a ceiling on what he's going to bring. But I do think that there are some things that he does well, but this is very much, as one of my colleagues at Sharp Football Analysis likes to say, it's a horizontal raid. This is not necessarily like a deep raid. This is more of a horizontal raid. They are going fast, trying to get the ball out quickly, and a lot of stuff is underneath. They're going to need to find some success from a balanced perspective with the ground game and the pass game, because we know that in today's football, it is very difficult to matriculate the ball down the field anymore. I did a detailed analysis this offseason, once again, about the teams that are the most explosive. And those teams, it doesn't matter, like, even like the Chiefs, maybe not necessarily the most explosive team last year particularly, but the teams that are the most explosive tend to go the furthest in the playoffs. They tend to have the most success. Explosiveness is what allows you to bypass a lot of mistakes. It overcomes mistakes, and defenses try to force them more than ever with the two deeps and trying to keep things underneath. If you play right into that and you're throwing a lot of the time behind the line of scrimmage, you're throwing underneath, and you're not really trying to test the defense, you're going to have a really difficult time matriculating the ball down the field on 10, 12, 13 play drives and trying to result in seven. So they need to figure out a little bit more ways to get explosive, but I agree there's a ceiling here with Cliff Kingsbury and how he's lining up players and his lack of motion and his lack of, motion gives the quarterback answers before the snap. It's one of the things you should be looking to do with a young quarterback is helping give him answers, like reading Cliff notes before you go to a test, or having the ability to have a really nice index card to take into one of your exams. Having some of these answers before you actually get the questions is pretty nice, and that's what motion does, and he doesn't like to use it very frequently.
Warren, great as always, buddy. Really appreciate the time and the insight.
Thanks, guys.
Good having you on. Check him out, Sharp Football and Sharp Football Analytics, joining us here on G&D. The numbers are back in on the ratings for the NFL in week one, and
they're
astronomical. I want to go over some of those. Plus, what did we get right? What did we get wrong through 1 week of football? We'll get to that next on Grant and Danny.
I'm John Aran, and I have a new podcast called The Varsity. I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media. Available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
G&D on the Fan, our double play comes your way at 3:45, and we will be blitzing today at 4 o'clock, a half hour from right now, at the top of the hour. We'll get to what we got right and what we got wrong as it pertains to week one in the NFL. But speaking of week one in the National Football League, how about some of these TV numbers, Danny? I'm going to run through these for you. Total audience in week one for the NFL, Thursday through Monday. Standalone Thursday night football game, Chiefs-Ravens. Friday night international game, Eagles-Packers. And then the games all day Sunday. Into Monday night football. 123 million people. The highest week one total audience since 2019. Now, I'd imagine that's buoyed a little bit by having an extra standalone game on Friday.
Yep.
But still.
It's still, they're doing fine.
You got to go back 5 years to find the last time they had that many people and that many eyeballs on them in the first week of the season. You go to the next line here. 21 million people, TV and digital. That's average viewers per NFL game. 21 million at a time, on average, watching NFL games. Up 12% from last year. The most watched week one on record. 21 million per game. This is what printing money sounds like, by the way. Network performances, NBC's kickoff game, and week one Sunday night football game. So that would have been the Ravens-Chiefs with the Sunday night game between the Lions and the Rams. 25 million people, up 3% from last year. The highest two-game kickoff weekend average since 2015, 9 years ago. Sunday afternoon, this is just your, you know, 1 o'clock, 4
o'clock. Just your regular old ones.
CBS and Fox windows. Highest week one Sunday afternoon viewership since 2016, 8 years ago. Up 21% from last year. How about an average of 18.4 million people tuning in to Sunday afternoon football contests?
They can do whatever they want.
And here's the last one I'll give you. Monday Night Football on ABC, ESPN+, ESPN2. Now, this is with many people in America, millions, I'd imagine, boxed out by the dispute between Disney and DirecTV.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about this?
I do, yeah.
I'm a DirecTV consumer. Now, I'm also, luckily, a YouTube TV consumer. I have both right now. The double dip for September, mm-hmm, while I'm waiting for the Nats season to end, and then the second it does, Qigong, DirecTV's out until next April at the earliest, if it's back. I hope all offseason that the Nats find a way that I don't need it again.
Wouldn't that be nice if they did that?
That would be great.
One time.
Monday Night Football, ABC, ESPN+, ESPN2. Second most watched Monday Night Football week one game since 2000. What is that?
God.
Is that an Aaron Rodgers effect? I don't understand that. You got to go back to 24 years ago. There's only been one game more people tuned in for on Monday Night Football. 20.4 million. An astounding week one performance in the National Football League.
So those numbers just kind of, you know, it starts to become rainfall at certain points where they just sound astronomical and you don't even know if it's good, bad, indifferent. Just trust us that it's good. But here's what's amazing to me. At a time where fewer and fewer and fewer people are watching anything else on television, those numbers going up is that much more remarkable. In other words, on an average night, now there's no such thing for us in our in football watching households, but for the rest of America, for the people that aren't necessarily tuning in, aren't part of the rhythms of it, and on your average Wednesday, fewer people than ever per capita are going, I'm going to watch the programming offered by ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, whatever. I've got other options. It used to be cable was the other option, then AMC, the HBOs of the world would sort of enter their hats into the ring with the prestige television shows.
There's a movie on TBS tonight.
Yeah, so they're all kind of trying to crawl or claw their piece of the pie away. Enter the streaming apps, which changed everything. Oh, have you watched the new Yellowstone? Well, have you watched the offshoot show by the guy Taylor Sheridan who does this? Well, are you watching The Bear on Hulu? Are you watching the 97 trillion things that come out on Netflix every hour? What about the new Prime Prestige show? There's a billion and one options. Fewer people than ever are just going, what's on Channel 4? What's on Channel 7? Like, nobody does that anymore, pretty much. And for the NFL to go, that's nice, into the headwind that everyone else is getting blown back 1,000 yards, they're planting their flag further than it's ever been. It's unreal.
They are a juggernaut who can't be stopped. And we keep thinking, you and I, but also just the collective royal we, everybody, whether it's head trauma or it's some type of, you know, the controversies with players off the field occasionally or owners, that there's just going to be a moment where there's a bit of a reckoning. And maybe the roll is slowed. And it just doesn't seem like it. No. It seems like it's a ball rolling downhill. And this ball just picks up more and more and more snow. And eventually it's an avalanche now.
And it's not just a hill in your neighborhood either. That's Mount Everest. It's rolling down.
I don't know how it would slow down. There is still this belief. I saw, who was it? It was Mark Cuban 10 years ago in 2014. Said the NFL's too greedy. They're trying to do too many things internationally or, games on different days of the week. More of a good thing is always going to water it down. And his point was they're too greedy. It's going to be...
The pig that gets too fat gets slaughtered.
Totally. And 10 years from now, it's going to be in trouble. That was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I saw that quote come back today. Now, someone might be saying the same thing today, and we'll have to fast forward to 2034 and look back. But it's all worked. I mean, everything they're doing seems to be getting them going even more and more in the right direction, mm-hmm. financially at least. I don't know if the sport is better, if the games are better, if the quality of play is better, but the business is certainly booming. There's no doubt about that. All right, let's get to what we got right, what we got wrong from around the NFL in week one as we start to look ahead today to week number two. Thing I got most wrong, I think, was this Bengals and Patriots matchup.
Here, here.
From both perspectives, right? I got Cincinnati winning the AFC North. I said Joe Burrow, healthy going into the season, would be able to put on a show early in the season, that he would not be hindered by Ja'Marr Chase having held out. I didn't think T. Higgins was going to miss, but that's not a good enough excuse. 10 points for them, 224 yards, 4.7 a pop. They were bad. And the Patriots were every bit as terrible as I thought they'd be with Jacoby Brissett under center offensively, but their defense was magnificent. They were dominant. They were so good and ended up winning the football game almost single-handedly. So I thought the Patriots would not win for weeks. I thought the Bengals were going to look like a division champion right out of the chute, and I couldn't have been more wrong.
Yeah, I echo that one. I rubber stamp it. Thing I got right, the Carolina Panthers should be relegated. They are terrible. They are awful. They cannot do it. They are picking first in the draft yet again. They would have done it another year in a row, except they had to give Chicago their first-round pick. I think I was wrong about speaking of Chicago. I thought that offense would be a lot better out the gate. They were anemic at times. They really struggled. No rhythm, no timing. Nothing looked good in week one. Tennessee deserves some credit for that. Defensively, I think they're going to be frisky and a pain in the butt. But not to the tune of your number one draft pick only throwing for 93 yards or whatever the hell it was. They were not good on that side of the football. I was wrong about that.
Thing I got right, Aaron Rodgers, Kirk Cousins coming back from Achilles injuries, it's going to take time. And especially, I will say, I thought Rodgers played better than Cousins did, but that the Jets are just not going to be that good very quickly. They have a very easy schedule coming up. Have you seen their schedule?
I did. It's why I picked them to win the division.
Their schedule in the next handful of weeks is Charmin soft. They've got the Titans this weekend, then the Patriots, then the Broncos, then the Vikings. They could very easily be 4-1 going into a showdown with the Bills on October 14th. They should at least win their next three and be 3-1 going into that Minnesota game. But I just didn't think it would come easily when a quarterback misses as much time as Rodgers has, a year and a half without playing football at his age, and some new pieces being thrown together there.
Thing I was right about, the Arizona Cardinals are not good, but they are frisky. They're a pain in the butt. They're part of that middle bucket. Last year, they were pretty atrocious, especially without Kyler Murray. They were the better team in that Buffalo game for, you know, probably almost two-thirds of it, but Josh Allen put his cape on. Thing I was wrong about, again, in that same game, I thought Buffalo was going to struggle at times. And maybe you could say that they did, but the thing I underestimated is their quarterback, when right, is so bleeping good that it doesn't matter. That's adorable. Defense let up a whole bunch. That's adorable. I don't have Stephon Diggs in his prime anymore. Watch me figure it out. Josh Allen was superhuman.
The thing I was wrong about, I thought the Green Bay Packers would be a team you didn't want to play in September, and they looked really bad in a quirky, weird international game, which I won't completely hold against them. Terrible field conditions. But Jordan Love was pretty ugly in that game. A 50% passer, 17 of 34, threw a bad interception, and now he's hurt. So they are turning things over to Malik Willis very likely for at least a game. I would think probably a couple. Although there is some speculation out there that maybe Jordan Love would come back and be able to play. I just don't know how that would be the case. That seems like wishful thinking. How do you not have a better plan than Malik Willis? Every time I've ever seen him play, he does not look like he belongs on an NFL field. They got the Colts this weekend, and then the Titans after that. This is the underbelly of the schedule.
Mm-hmm.
I thought beat Philly, and I picked them to do so, by the way. You're going to be 3-0 playing the Vikings at the end of the month. They now might be 0-3 going into that game, hopefully with Jordan Love back. I guess his health notwithstanding, but I just don't give them much of a chance with Malik Willis. Am I overreacting?
No, you are appropriately reacting, I would say. A thing that I was wrong about, I'll start there. I thought Cleveland would be a lot better. I didn't know that they would win in week one against Dallas. Dallas is still pretty decent. But they looked anemic. They looked out just totally overmatched on both sides of the football, by the way. At least I thought that Cleveland defense would travel and certainly be more capable. They were terrible in week number one. I don't know how much of a gavel slam I'm doing on that, but they were certainly really, really bad. So I was wrong about that. Thing I was right about is Pittsburgh's offense still stinks. They didn't score a touchdown. Didn't matter because their defense was great and TJ Watt showed up. He made the trip. But no matter what you do, they're not a high-scoring group. And Mike Tomlin did the Mike Tomlin thing where they don't score an offensive touchdown and they still win. It's amazing.
Some of what we got right, some of what we got wrong from the first week of the NFL season. Our double plays coming up here in just a couple of moments. I just got a tweet from somebody. They retweeted Warren Sharp. Sharp, 13 minutes ago, so after he got off the phone with us, looked up the percentages of motion from Cliff Kingsbury through the years. Obviously, was the thing we were talking about with him on the show. So 2020, 32nd, 2021, 32nd, 2022, 28th, and then 27th this weekend. Point being, he does not really use motion before the snap. But anyway, someone retweeted that and said, Grant, you got to talk about this. Now, I know people have lives. Not everyone can listen all the time. But that is kind of funny. It's all we've been talking about. In fact, we just had Warren Sharp on, and we brought it up to him, and he looked up the numbers while he was on the line with us, and that's why he sent the tweet. It's just funny that someone retweeted it at me and goes, you guys got
to
talk.
You guys have to address this. Are you planning on it?
We will address that next. I only kid. Double play is next on G&D, and then the Beltway Blitz in 20 minutes on The Fan. It's time for the G&D Double Play, driven to you by your local Washington area Honda dealers. Stop in for a great deal on the rugged and capable Honda Pilot. Contact your local Washington area Honda dealers today.
Been a couple days. I would have done this the other day, but we got super busy and it kind of broke late in the show. But James Earl Jones passed away at 93. No other way to describe it than one of the all-time legends. Iconic roles, that word gets thrown around a ton, GP, but the single greatest reveal to that point, perhaps in movie history, after fans had waited for 3 years from the original Star Wars to The Empire Strikes Back, Darth Vader voiced by James Earl Jones. And there's no internet, there's no spoilers, there's no You know, people coming out and tweeting the results. There's no Danny Ruye is ruining Game of Thrones for people. This is 3 years in the making, and only it's word of mouth. The greatest twist that nobody saw coming, again, to that point perhaps, in history, expertly delivered by James Earl Jones in that sound booth. Only a few people knew the truth. The actor playing Darth Vader, David Prowse, in the suit didn't know. Most of the cast, not in fact all the cast, didn't know. George Lucas, Irvin Kershner, and then Mark Hamill, right before the scene, George Lucas went and told him, you're going to react this way because here's the truth. Expertly delivered and perfect. And perfect is the word that comes to mind with James Earl Jones a bunch. He was perfect as Darth Vader. He was perfect as Terrence Mann opposite Kevin Costner in Field of Dreams. He was perfect in The Lion King. He was perfect as Eddie Murphy's father, even in a comedic role where he was the straight man as King Joffrey. He was absolutely incredible and awesome and just iconic. I don't have another word to describe it, but 93 years plus, what an unbelievable life. What a huge impact he had on so many people. So never really like the guy that starred as the lead in a bunch of movies, but just sort of found this lane to provide gravity. I mean, I think of him in Hunt for Red October as the boss of the CIA, Jack Ryan's boss. Just perfect. He was so good in so many roles. And when you start to add them all up, and I'm probably forgetting a half dozen just now.
You're forgetting one very important one in The Sandlot, where he was Mr. Myrtle.
And he's perfect in that?
Oh, I loved him in that. So the line in that movie that still pops me so good is the whole film, they're trying to get the ball back, and they're petrified of the guy that lives there and the dog behind the wall, although they don't know it's a dog, it's a beast, right? But anyway, they finally just decide, we're going to, you know, go tell this guy what's going on with your dog, who chased us all over the place, and they got to go talk to Mr. Myrtle. And they hand him the baseball, and he's blind, essentially, and he, like, smells it, and he's, rubbing it on his face, and he goes, George signed this ball, talking about Babe Ruth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I don't know why that line always gets me, but George signed this ball. And they're like, George, you know Babe Ruth? And he's like, sure did. And then he gives them the 1927 Yankees ball. And he tells them, you know, I tell you what, you keep this baseball. You just come back and talk with me once a week. What a great end to that movie that was.
Just so perfect. I mean, man, and again, I'm sure I'm missing probably again dozens of roles because he was acting since like the 1950s, 1960s, even as a kid. But that if you needed the voice, and you know exactly what I'm talking about, if you needed someone to do a voice that had gravitas or to narrate or to have depth in that booming bass, he was so awesome.
Short list all time Hall of Fame voice, right? I mean, if you're talking about like Mount Rushmore of voices. Narration, his is in there.
Yeah, it's him, it's Orson Welles, Morgan Freeman.
I would say Morgan Freeman is definitely up there. Honestly, Liev Schreiber, maybe.
Yes.
Currently. Michael Douglas did a lot of narrating. His is different, but is kind of probably in terms of like money made doing stuff is up there. But yeah, I don't know. How many people had a better voice ever than James Earl Jones?
Very few. Very few. Very few.
So deep.
Totally. I mean, again, and now it's, you know, every time they are able to do, or every time there's like a new Star Wars project or anything that comes with it, you're sitting there, you just hope, do we get the real one? You know, like that brief moment in Rogue One, Star Wars story, the first time you see Darth Vader on screen and it's him and he delivers the voice. It just makes the movie work. And now this is legitimate. You know what I mean? Like adding his presence to it makes it real. It makes it matter. Just an incredible, incredible, incredible impact on so many people. So rest in peace, James Earl Jones.
It is time for my double play. Darius, if you don't mind, can you fire up a little Clarissa Explains It All for us here on Grant and Danny? I'd like to tag in Ryan Clary.
Oh.
Now, I don't think this one's all that difficult, to be honest, because it's been in the news quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I do have something I'd like Ryan to explain to me, if he's able to. I want to know what the Solheim Cup is.
So, okay. I saw, I believe, ABC7 was there today, and I saw people tweeting about it, and obviously it's a golf tournament of some sort, but golf season is over. PGA is done with, so it's not a PGA Tour event.
Are you sure?
I'm 100% sure. PGA Tour is over at this point in time. It ends right when football season starts. So I'm going to assume that this is some like wacky kind of deal where, I mean, it's in the DC area. I know that.
Every year?
Sure. We'll say so.
Annually in DC.
Annually in DC. And maybe it's a golf tournament between Capitol Hill employees, like Republicans versus Democrats. I don't know what it is at this point.
Honestly, every now and then you come up with something and you hit a home run.
Thank you. It's
an annual golf tournament between the Republicans and the Democrats.
Because they have their congressional baseball game, and then they have the Solheim Cup.
So you watched the ABC 7 story on it today?
I did not. I saw, I'm blanking on her name right now, but I saw her tweet live from it, so I was thinking like, oh, that's cool, and I just kind of continued
to
scroll.
I mean, the segment is obviously better if you don't get it right.
Of course.
But we've always said we don't pre-plan this.
No,
we don't tell Ryan to get things wrong. Sometimes he just knows something. Would you say this was something you knew or something you lucked into?
Just lucked into, I'd say.
Okay. And the Republicans and the Democrats play the congressional baseball game.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
Why wouldn't they just call it the congressional golf tournament? What is the importance of the Solheim Cup?
I don't know. It's what's the importance of the Stanley Cup? You know,
exactly.
One guy named Stanley decided, hey, this is going to be the Stanley Cup. Maybe one guy named Solheim was like, we'll call it the Solheim Cup or whatever the heck it is.
Yeah, it's named after Solheim.
Solheim.
I'll accept that. And then my last question then, because you didn't quite hit that, even though you've gotten everything else right, that was not correct.
Fair.
On the Solheim Cup, you said it's an annual event in D.C. Is it always held this week?
I'll say yes.
Is this year a little different than normal?
I'll say yes. Solheim Cup is held in D.C. every time this time of year.
And where is it being held now?
I'm going to guess Congressional Country Club out in Bethesda.
All right. Sounds about right. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Ryan Clary. The Solheim Cup.
Because I didn't know what it was. Now I do.
Now you do. Would you spell it for us, please?
S-O-L-H-E-I-M.
That is correct.
Ding, ding.
The Solheim Cup. Clary explains it all on Grant and Danny next. Your Beltway Blitz right here on The Fan.
I'm John Aran. And I have a new podcast called The Varsity. I will bring on the smartest people I know to break down the hottest topics in sports media. Available now on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.